If they got hit in their condition, they'd never make it out alive. It is imperative you reach checkpoint Echo by 1200 hours. A gust of cold wind suddenly swept through the sweltering jungle air. Then the first spattering of rain fell. Then it fell in a steady, continuous roar. The rain continued into the night. They stumbled on in the dark, the glowing green tip of the compass needle in Melis's hand moving before him. Then Vancouver hit a trail that headed south. Checkpoint Echo was south of them. "Take it," Melis said. "Fuck the ambushes." He figured that if he died, he wouldn't have to worry about the fucking decision anyway. Word came up the line that Hippie had stopped moving. When Melis reached him, Hippie could say nothing. He stood upright, swaying between two friends, his machine gun still cradled on his shoulder. He was staring emptily ahead. Melis finally spoke. "Can you keep going, Hippie? Just a few more hours?" Hippie looked at him from a long way away. Then he nodded. Melis nodded back, watching Hippie's face. It was just the face of an 18-year-old kid with a peace medallion around his neck. Hippie wore a pair of wire-rimmed glasses, had straggly hair, and had the beginnings of a beard. An ordinary human face. Melis had never really looked at one before. They made it to Checkpoint Echo about an hour before dawn, formed a circle, and collapsed on the ground. Lieutenant Stevens, the artillery liaison officer, being junior, had the early morning watch again when Fitch radioed in that Bravo Company was at Checkpoint Echo, back in communication but with weak power sources and waiting for further orders. He was requesting food and an emergency medical evacuation for about 10 Marines, a body, and a German Shepherd. 20 minutes later, Stevens briefed Lieutenant Colonel Simpson when Simpson made his customary visit before breakfast. Simpson asked when they'd arrived. Stevens, knowing that Fitch was already in trouble for being slow, tried to help out by saying that they'd reached Echo around 2200 hours the night before.
"Good. They had a good night's rest. Tell Lieutenant Fitch to build a zone and we'll get him in some fresh power sources. Also, send him this message."
He paused while Stevens dug out a small green notepad.
"Upon resupply, proceed immediately Hill 1609. Prepare LZ for future use as fire support base sky cap. Imperative you be there 1200 hours tomorrow. Code that," Simpson continued. "And I want those power sources delivered ASAP. That outfit's been candy-assing enough out there. I don't want any more excuses for them sitting on their butts."
Simpson started to walk out into the darkness. "Sir, what about the emergency medevacs and rations?" Stevens asked. Simpson stopped.
"Lieutenant, what would you do if you had command? You've got a company out in the bush under the guidance of completely inexperienced officers. They eat their rations too quickly and then run out because they are slowed down by immersion foot caused by their own neglect. As a consequence, they are at the moment way behind schedule in opening a very important fire support base. They are also, I presume, a little hungry and their feet hurt."
He smiled at his joke.
"If they succeed in building the LZ on Hill 1609 on schedule, they'll have all the helicopters they like by noon tomorrow. The first thing a young officer has to learn is to take responsibility for his actions and to have some pride. Pride, Lieutenant Stevens. It's what the Marine Corps is built on."
Because of the COMLO operation, no Marine chopper could be diverted to carry a few batteries to a company in the bush. Stevens contacted every outfit he could think of. He finally found an Army Huey that was free for the morning, having carried a general from Da Nang up to Dong Ha. He talked the pilot into making a quick run. At Checkpoint Echo, with K-bars, machetes, and Jackson's method of throwing their bodies against the brush, they slowly opened a small patch of crumpled, twisted vegetation in the broad valley floor. Above them, on all sides, the mountains towered dark and green, their tops hidden by clouds. Stevens's message to expect a Huey had come in the clear. The order to create fire support base Skycap had come coded. All the actuals gathered around Relsnick as he worked out the code. When he read the order, there was stunned silence. Mellis pulled his map from his side pocket and found Hill 1609. It was at the source of the river that flowed from the mountains to their east, down to Checkpoint Echo, where it joined the river that they had followed the night before. He looked at the peaks. Their tops were hidden by clouds. Goodwin came over to him.
"Where the fuck is it, Jack?"
he asked. Mellis pointed.
"Shit, Jack,"
Goodwin said. One by one, each of the actuals looked at where Mellis's finger was pointing. Upon seeing the location, Hawk went into the Hawk dance, screeching,
"Skycap! Skycap! Snack! Snack! Skycap!"
He cupped his hands and shouted,
"Skycap! Kahoo! Kahoo!"
The cry echoed back. He stopped and held up both hands toward the mountains in the Hawk power sign and gave two more cries of, "Snack! Snack!" Then he rested both hands on the top of his head and just stood there, his back to the group, looking east toward the mountains. Fitch took command.
"Get your medevacs ready," he said. "We'll be kicking off as soon as we get resupplied. We'll have 20 minutes for chow. Don't let them go hog wild or they'll get sick. One sea rat, you got me? One."
Fitch again turned to squint at the barrier of green to their east.
"Kendall, it's your turn to have point. You can't get lost going up a river."
Kendall flushed, but then smiled when Fitch and the others grinned good-naturedly at him. Jackson told Mellis that he didn't want to be squad leader any longer.
"I just don't like telling my friends what to do all the time."
"You mean you can't take the heat? What do you want me to do, put Cortell in charge? Or maybe you'd like Parker making the decisions?"
Jackson looked at the ground, unwilling to meet the lieutenant's eyes.
"Do you think I give a flying fuck about how you feel right now?" Mellis went on. "I've got to have a good squad leader. I've got to have one."
Jackson fiddled with a grenade hanging from his belt suspenders.
"Jank's probably been back from R&R over a week," he said. "He's just sitting on his ass at VCB. I only was supposed to have it temporarily."
Mellis's voice changed.
"God damn it, Jackson, we need you."
Jackson looked up at Mellis. The idea made him stop. No one had ever needed him like this in his life. He tried to see it the lieutenant's way. Cortell was probably the only other guy on the squad who could lead it. He was so smart it was scary, but Cortell's kind of smart was deep smart. Out here, it was fast smart that counted. His kind. He'd felt okay being a fire team leader, but then Jank still carried the real load and took the consequences if he screwed up. That was just it. Jank never screwed up. Maybe he, Jackson, would, and if he did, he would never get another chance to lead again. But if he didn't lead now, he wouldn't get another chance either. He'd written home about being a squad leader. Imagine him in charge of 12 guys. His old man had never been in charge of anybody. Jackson looked at the lieutenant's young, earnest face.
"Fuck China."
"I can take the heat, Lieutenant,"
he almost whispered. The two of them stood there, looking at each other, silent for perhaps 3 seconds. Then Mella spoke. "You're the squad leader, and I'm the platoon commander, whether we like it or not. There it is."
"Yeah, that is," Jackson said.
He started toward his squad sector and then turned to look back at Mellis.
"But when Jank gets back, I quit."
"Okay, Jackson. It's a deal." Half an hour later, they heard the sound of a helicopter. They strained to catch a glimpse. Someone shouted and pointed. The sound grew to a roar, and a dark bulb flitted briefly across the clouds and was then lost. The roar returned. Fitch popped a smoke grenade, and thick red smoke began to coil upward from the foliage. An Army Huey slick flashed overhead, then banked in a graceful climbing turn to the left.
"Big John Bravo, this is Bitterroot 7. We've got a red smoke next to a blue line. Over."
Fat Man's voice came over the radio, assuring the pilot that they were by a river and it wasn't a trap.
"Wind down here is negligible.
Your best approach is from the south. Zone secure. Over. The helicopter, numbers gleaming, turned to the south, turned again, and made its approach. It set gently down, the air vibrating with the blades. The whine of the turbine ceased and the blades whiffled to a halt. The pilot, dressed in a crisp flight suit, stepped out of the bird. Cassidy had a work party ready to receive the supplies. Fitch and Hawk met the pilot at the edge of the rotor blades. Mellis, unable to hold himself back, walked out for a closer look. A crew member handed out two boxes of batteries to two of the work party. A third Marine stepped up, waiting for his load of sea rations. Mellis saw the crew member shrug his shoulders. The Marine turned to look at Cassidy, stunned. Mellis rushed over to the small group who were just shaking hands with the pilot.
"Hey, you got any food?"
he burst in. The pilot, a warrant officer about Mellis's age, looked at him.
"No,"
he said, puzzled.
"Why? You guys out?"
"Well, no," Mellis lied. "Just wondered if maybe they threw on something." The pilot looked around him. He seemed excited about being so far out in the bush and helping out another service.
"Jesus, you guys smell," he said with a smile. "You been here long?"
"No," Fitch said. "We just got in this morning." He looked at Mellis and Hawk, obviously wondering what could have gone wrong with the resupply.
"This morning?"
The pilot looked at Mellis.
"Whatever possessed you people to hump down here at night?"
Mellis's chin was trembling. "We thought we'd avoid the heat," he managed to choke out. He turned and walked away.
"What's with him?"
the pilot asked Fitch and Hawk.
"He's a little tired," Hawk said. "Had point all night. Don't take it personally."
"Sure, I can understand that."
"Say," Hawk added, "if you could do us another favor, we'd really appreciate a huss."
"Name it. I gotta wait around while the general talks to your guys in Dong Ha. Glad to do something."
"Well, we've got some guys that'd due to go on R&R, things like that. Then there's another guy who's really overdue to go home. The company shouldn't be carrying him. It'd sure help morale if we could get them out."
"Sure. How many you got?"
"How many can you take?" Hawk asked evenly. "They're all fairly light."
The worst cases of immersion foot hobbled up to the edge of the landing zone. They exchanged their better clothing with those staying behind. By the time they were helped aboard by the crew chief, they looked very bad indeed. Cortell and Jackson struggled up to the side of the slick with Williams. They looked inquiringly at the crew chief and pilot, who were transfixed by the bloated, discolored hands wrapped around the pole. The crew chief lost control and gagged, but managed not to throw up.
"If there's not enough room," Cortell said, "we could tie him to the skids."
"No, it's not that,"
the pilot managed to say, still trying to hold his breath. He waved toward the chopper door. The Marines who were already aboard pulled the body in. Corporal Aaron carried Pat onto the chopper with him. Pat lay still, his eyes staring blankly, waiting for his handler to fix the hunger and sickness. He tried to lick Aaron's hand. The two Vietnamese Kit Carsons walked nervously onto the small zone. Everyone watched them silently. Most of the Marines had forgotten that they existed. The Kit Carsons crawled into the body of the chopper. The Marines on board ignored them. Hippie had been waiting with the gun squad in the high grass at the edge of the zone. When the pilot climbed back into the chopper, he knew for certain that he was going home. He turned and handed Young his machine gun, as if exchanging colors. Then he grinned to break the solemnity.
"Don't forget you're the only Chuck left in guns," he said. "Since you can't wear a noose, maybe this will help."
He lifted his peace medallion from his neck and handed it to Young. He shook hands slowly with Moll.
"They're all yours, Moll. Promise me. No Pancho Villa bullshit. You make sure they keep the fucking ammo in the cans and not all over their chests so it'll shoot when they need it."
Moll nodded.
"You hang in there, Mallory,"
Hippie said, and shook his hand too. Mallory nodded rapidly. Jacobs shook Hippie's hand and then offered to help him out to the chopper.
Hippy refused the offer and walked out of the war one step at a time. 20 minutes after the chopper left, the company waded into the river following Kendall. The clouds had lowered and a steady rain spattered the water. Within an hour they were moving between steep hills whose tops came into and out of view through the clouds. In another hour they were moving between low cliffs that got gradually higher as they moved east towards Skycap. Late that afternoon, knee-deep in the rushing water, Parker collapsed, his contorted jaw clamping his teeth together. His scream echoed up and down the river between the rocky cliffs. Mellis reached Parker before Fredrickson. Cortell was cradling his head out of the water. Parker's eyes rolled and blood dribbled down his chin from his lacerated tongue. Mellis tore off a branch and stuffed it into Parker's mouth. By the time Doc Fredrickson got there, the fit seemed to have passed. Parker was sweating heavily, even with the water flowing over his body.
"Why didn't you tell someone you were epileptic?" Fredrickson asked softly.
Parker just stared at him.
"What's epileptic?"
Fredrickson looked at Mellis, surprise on his face. He started shaking down his thermometer, his forehead creased with worry.
"It ain't like anything I saw in field, Mad," he said.
Fitch was on the radio asking what was holding things up. He ordered Kendall to push off, and the column began to move past them. Parker attempted to get up, but Fredrickson pushed him down. His temperature was 105 degrees. The senior squid, Scheller, arrived. He, Fredrickson, and Mellis talked quietly where Parker couldn't hear them. Rain fell steadily, soundless in the river's roar. The clouds were at the cliff tops. If the whole company went back to the LZ at Checkpoint Echo, it would delay Skycap's opening by a full day. If Fitch sent Parker back with a single platoon might get hit in a canyon going back, and a reduced company might get hit in a canyon going forward. They couldn't get Parker back to Echo before dark anyway, so an evacuation there was problematical before morning. Humping in the dark also increased the risk of injuries. Mellis suggested getting a bird to work its way up the river. Because the canyon walls blocked the PRC-25's line of sight transmissions, Resnick couldn't contact a battalion. Daniels managed to contact a forward air observer on a weather check above the clouds who acted as a relay. The word came back. Flying in a canyon with its erratic winds was risky. A blade could hit a cliff. Unless it was a clear emergency, they wouldn't risk a chopper and its crew. With malaria, dysentery, and many other tropical diseases, temperatures of 105 were common and not immediately life-threatening. They could medevac Parker when they opened the LZ on 1609. Scheller asked,
"You think you can hump Parker?" "What the fuck you think?"
Parker spat out.
"I got a choice."
Parker rose shakily to his feet. There was sweat on his face, mixing with the rain. He picked up his pack, shrugged into it, and stepped off into the river.
"You think he's faking?"
Mellis asked Scheller.
"You don't fake a temperature like that on a bloody tongue, sir. I think he's really sick. I'd turn the company around and medevac him from Echo."
"Never happen," Fredrickson said.
"There it is," said Mellis.
At dusk, Fitch ordered Kendall to climb out of the canyon to find a safe position for the night. It was a difficult, dangerous climb that took 2 hours. One of Goodwin's men fell backward, badly bruising a knee, when a root he was holding pulled loose. Everyone breathed with relief that the man's back wasn't hurt. He could still carry his own gear. At the top, Mellis met Kendall in the dark. He was guiding everyone to his position.
"Nice job today, Kendall," he said. Kendall nodded. "Hard to get lost in a fucking canyon," he said. "Even for me."
Mellis laughed. He wondered why he had been so hard on Kendall. It wasn't Kendall's idea to be out here. Was it such a great failing not to be cut out to be a Marine infantry officer?
Maybe in war it was.
Fog set in. They could hear the steady roar of the river far below them, an ominous and frightening noise because it would muffle the sound of anyone sneaking up on them. It had been their sixth day in a row, without food. 2 hours before midnight, someone from Kendall's platoon screamed for a corpsman. A kid had suddenly gone into a fit, his temperature shooting dangerously upward. At 2 in the morning, Parker went into convulsions again. His choked screaming was that of a man no longer in control of his mind. When Fredrickson tried to take his temperature, Parker continued to jerk his head violently, saying no to someone who wasn't present, spitting out the thermometer. Fredrickson stuck it under his armpit.
106, Lieutenant, Fredrickson said. That's outside the body. His brain is cooking.
Parker started crying.
I don't want to die. Not here. Not here. I don't want to die.
Cortell clasped his hands and prayed.
You believe in Jesus, Parker. I know you do,
he said. He poured water on the soaked field dressing that Fredrickson had placed on Parker's forehead. Scheller arrived and looked into Parker's eyes with a flashlight.
Chalandover with 3rd Platoon's got the exact same thing, he said. It's nothing I ever seen. We don't get them cooled down, though, they'll die.
He looked up at Mellis.
We'll get an emergency medevac this time for sure. The question is where?
Mellis's mind raced. Here above the canyon, they were in jungle with 200-foot trees, and the fog came right to the ground. The canyon had narrowed considerably since Parker's first episode, but it had been clear of fog. It seemed the only choice. He remembered a wide spot just before Kendall took them off the river. He radioed Fitch. 10 minutes later, Vancouver was leading the way down to the river. Parker and Challand, the kid from Kendall's platoon, were both slung in ponchos. Parker kept moaning, so they stuffed part of his shirt in his mouth. Mellis and Vancouver emerged from the jungle onto the canyon rim, somewhat ahead of the rest. They were a good 40 feet above the river. Mellis's heart sank. Was the flat area upstream or down?
He looked at his watch.
Daylight in another hour. It had taken them 2 hours to make it to the river. He knew he was close. But what if he wasn't? They could be trapped in the river in the dark and moving in the wrong direction. They'd lose both Parker and Challand. It was his call. He huddled over his map, hiding the dim red glow of his flashlight. The breeze made his back cold. He squinted into the dark, trying to identify any terrain feature that would help him make the right choice. There was a loud groan and a sound of falling rocks as the litter bearers emerged from the jungle. Jackson came up to him.
Doc says we got to cool Park off quick, sir. Park ain't even making sense anymore.
Get the rope, Mellis said. We'll take him over the edge right here. I think we got to be close to the spot.
Here?
Here, goddammit, get some security set up behind us.
Jackson put Tillman, Amarillo, Breuer, and Pellini in an arc behind them to serve as a human tripwire against any NVA who might have zeroed in on their noise. He looped the rope around a tree, and he and Mellis dangled both ends into the darkness of the canyon. Mellis pulled it back up, relieved to find both ends wet. That meant that the first repeller would reach the bottom safely. It also meant that the river was right next to the cliff, so the wide spot wasn't here. Without being told, Vancouver wrapped the rope around his waist, walked out backward over the edge, and disappeared. Mellis crawled on his stomach, trying to watch Vancouver's descent in the dark. The rope slackened. Vancouver's voice floated up.
It ain't bad, Lieutenant. We even got some rock up out of the water.
3 others went over the edge to set up security. 2 upstream and 2 down. Then they lowered Parker and Challand to the water. Soon only a very frightened Breuer and Tillman were left above to provide security where the rope was tied. Fredrickson and Cortell undressed Parker, except for his boots, leaving only his head out of the water. Challand, his fever having suddenly abated, sat by the river's edge, shivering uncontrollably. One of the squad mates took off his flak jacket and wrapped his arms around Challand, trying to warm him. Mellis sent Vancouver and another kid upstream, and Jackson and another downstream. Jackson returned first. He'd found the wide spot. They lifted Parker to the litter and carried him downstream, whistling for Breuer and Tillman to come down the rope.
Mellis told them to pull it down and wait there for Vancouver. Mellis slipped and fell in the water 3 times before they finally reached the wide place. They laid Parker on his back on the rocks. He was fully conscious, the river flowing around him, cooling his body. Cortell knelt beside him.
"I've been scared before," Parker said. "But I didn't think it'd be like this. You'll be okay. We get a bird in for you. Jesus be with you, brother."
Parker looked up at the darkness above him. His eyes closed. Then he reached out, grabbing for anything. Cortell took his hand, squeezing it hard.
"I don't want to die here, Cortell. I don't want to die here."
He started moaning softly. Mellis and Fredrickson looked on, the water running across the tops of their boots. Mellis's throat ached. He screwed up his eyes, forcing the tears back. He'd never watched anyone die.
"It'll be okay, Parker," said Cortell. "Brother, we just baptize you right here on the spot. Jesus wash all your sins away." "I was going to kill the gunny." "That's okay, Parker, so was I."
"You didn't?"
"I rigged his grenade, but he must have found it. It was only luck I didn't kill him."
"That's okay." Cortell was slowly pouring water from his hands onto Parker's forehead.
"We call that grace. I know I should never done it. That's why I got this fever."
Parker rolled to his side, his elbow slipping on a loose rock beneath the water. He lunged for Cortell, who helped him turn on his back, cradling his head in the stream. He lay there and began sobbing.
"How can I go to hell, Cortell? Forever? How can I? How can it be so fucking bad? Not like this. How can I go to hell?"
"You ain't going to hell. That way you've been. You just asked Jesus to forgive you."
Cortell gently poured another handful of water onto Parker's head.
"I can't."
"Then I will."
Cortell let a third handful of water drain onto Parker's head. He placed his helmet on Parker's stomach. Then he bent over the helmet, hands folded, and closed his eyes.
"Lord Jesus, sweet Lord Jesus, you know this man, Duane Parker, who is about to come to thee. He has been a good man. He has seen some bad times. Now he asks you with all of his heart for you to forgive him so he might come to thee in thy glory. Lord Jesus, I know you hear me even here in this river. Amen."
Cortell took his helmet off Parker's stomach and placed it on his own head again. He put one hand on Parker's chest and moved it in a slow rhythm.
"You know my sister?"
Parker said.
"She's a cheerleader of her high school. She live with our great aunt now."
Parker was breathing rapidly.
"You tell her. You tell her I never much said anything nice to her, but I love her, huh? You tell her, Cortell."
"Sure, don't worry, she know that."
Cortell started singing a hymn. It was one that neither Fredrickson nor Mellis had heard. "Deep river, Lord, I want to cross over into campground, where all is peace." Mellis filled a hand with water for a drink. But he just looked at it and let the water drain from between his fingers. Then he covered his eyes with his palm, his wet fingers against his forehead to hide his tears. They waited there, looking east for the first light, listening for the sound of a chopper. Just before dawn, Parker went into convulsions and died as the three of them tried to keep him from drowning. Challand was still alive when the medevac bird came up the narrow gorge, fighting the erratic wind currents, the rotor wash spraying water behind it like a hydroplane. It took out 2 bodies not yet on the planet 20 years. One living and one dead. Word came back on the radio later that afternoon that the disease was called cerebral malaria. It was carried by an isolated species of mosquito found only in the mountains, and the usual pills didn't help against it. The odds were high that others in the company had been bitten as well. Mellis felt shadowed by disease and madness.
The company made only 3.5 kilometers that day. The gentle blue line on the map was a torrent on the ground. It ran between steep cliffs and through narrow gorges and had sudden waterfalls that required the use of ropes. It was the only path to the horseshoe of mountains that cradled its source, one of which a general or a staff officer had named Skycap. Fitch felt it would be best to climb out of the canyon to set in for the night. Blakely and Simpson disagreed. They had just sat through the 5th regimental staff meeting in a row, during which they had to explain why Bravo Company wasn't where Mulvaney had been told it would be. The order was relayed by an air observer. There will be no deviations from the line of march for any reason. To leave the canyon and lie about their position would be suicidal. The artillery might assume the company was someplace else and drop rounds on it. Since the company was strung out in the canyon with no way of circling into a defensive position or digging into the rock, Fitch felt he had no choice but to keep moving. At 1 in the morning, a kid in Kendall's platoon slipped on a steeply pitched wet slab. There was a thud, a splash, and a suppressed moan. He had fractured his left tibia, and the broken bone was sticking through the skin. Fitch told Relsnek to lose communications even if the battalion sent an air observer to act as a relay. They would wait for morning. The company's position was so precarious that neither Hawk nor Mellis could sleep. All night they sat huddled on a boulder, shivering in their damp clothes. Hamilton, however, lay sleeping on the rocks below them, his boots in the water.
"Imagine," Hawk said. "The first use of the column in the defense. We'll all get jobs at the Naval War College. We'll go down in military history."
"That's what I'm afraid of," Mellis said. "Going down." The cliff rose behind them. The moon occasionally broke through the cloud layer, and a cold wind blew on their backs. The conversation came and went. Girls they knew. What they would do after they got out. Building a fortress on Matterhorn and then abandoning it. Whether the Rolling Stones were better than the Beatles. Anything but cerebral malaria.
"Did you hear that Parker tried to kill Cassidy?" Mellis asked.
"Yeah, con man told me. It's all over the fucking company. Cassidy denies it. Says it's all black power bullshit that Parker just wanted to show off."
"You believe Cassidy?"
"I believe Parker."
"Is there going to be trouble?" Mellis asked.
"Don't know. Depends a lot on whether Parker did it on his own."
"You mean China?"
"I mean China if Parker didn't do it on his own, but I don't know." They listened to the water rushing past them. Hawk, looking sad, repeatedly traced a small pentangle on the rock beside him. "You feel bad about not getting the company?" Mellis asked.
"I don't know.
Sure. Sure, I wanted the company, but now I just went out of the fucking bush."
"Have you tried?
Like getting a job at the operations center like Stevens?"
"Do I look like a fucking dictaphone? What the fuck you trying to do, Mellis? Get rid of me?"
Mellis felt himself color slightly. He said nothing.
"Don't worry, Mellis," Hawk said. "You're so fucking boot, you'll still be here when I'm sucking down cool ones at O'Day's bar. You'll have plenty of time to get a fucking company. For starters, you'll probably be Bravo 5 if I ever do get my freckled ass out of here. Kendall's leaving in a few weeks, and Goodwin..." Hawk chuckled softly.
"Shit, Jack," he mimicked. "Scar. His lines are a mess. His paperwork's all fucked up, his radio procedure's a disaster... but the troops will follow him any place. Any place." Hawk blew some air through his lips. "That's the problem with him. He's a fighter."
"That's a problem?"
Mellis felt envious of Goodwin again, but his envy fought against the warmth evoked by the image of Goodwin tugging on an earlobe and cackling about a third Purple Heart.
"In this war it is," Hawk said. "That's probably why it's so fucked up. What you need in war is warriors, fighting, not little boys dressed up in soldier suits, administrating."
"Then why don't you make Scar the fucking 5? Mellis asked, a little more hotly than he'd intended.
because Goodwin would be eaten alive in 3 minutes, and not by the fucking NVA. You wouldn't, and you know it. In fact, I think you'd thrive on the fucking politics. They lapsed into silence. After a while, Hawk asked, "You know why we're really strung out in this fucking death canyon?" Mellis didn't know, so he just grunted. "Because Fitch doesn't know how to play the fucking game. That's why. He's a good combat leader. I'd literally follow him to my death. But he's not a good company commander in this kind of war. He got on Simpson's bad side because he got his picture in the paper too often and never gave Simpson credit, which, by the way, he doesn't deserve, but that's the point. The smart guy gives the guy with the power the credit, whether he deserves it or not. That way the smart guy is dangling something the boss wants. So the smart guy now has the power over the boss." Mellis kept his mouth shut. "It used to be if you were out in the bush operating independently like we are, no one would second-guess the skipper. They didn't have the radio power back then. Now they do, and the fucking brass think they're out on patrol. And now the smallest units are run by the colonels and generals, hell, right up to the president. Colonel and above used to be the level where people dealt with all the political shit like congressmen on junkets, television, reporters, you name it. But now those guys are running the show right down to this fucking river canyon, and we're in the politics, too. And the better the radios, the worse it's going to get. The politics is going to come right down to the company level, and people like Fitch and Scar are going to be culled out, and people like you will take over."
"What do you mean, like me?" Mellis asked quietly. Hawk sighed.
"Shit, Mellis, I mean a fucking politician."
Mellis stiffened. "Is that what you think of me?"
"Yeah, that's what I think."
Mellis said nothing.
"Shit, Mellis, don't get your feelings hurt. I didn't say I didn't like you, for Christ's sake, or you're some sort of bad person. Although I will grant you the company you'll keep is going to be sleazier than average. Just accept that you're a fucking politician. So was Abraham Lincoln and Winston Churchill. So was Dwight Eisenhower." He paused. "I didn't like their bad people. And they all ran a pretty good war."
Mellis smiled ruefully.
"You really think it's all about politics?"
Hawk blew air upward. Mellis could see his breath.
"No," he said. "You better believe it ain't all about politics."
He tossed a pebble into the stream and then looked directly at Mellis.
"Simpson's right. All these arms caches we're uncovering can only be a tiny percentage of the total. That means there's a lot of gooks around here. A lot. How the fuck do you think all that shit gets carried in without trucks except by a lot of fucking backs?"
He checked to see if he had Mellis's attention.
"The caches we've found are stashed in a line pointing east from Laos to the flats. To pull off that political op at Kam Lo, we had to pull back from Laos and the DMZ. Matterhorn controls the west end of Mudder's Ridge. Whoever controls Mudder's Ridge controls Route 9. If the NVA control Route 9, they can cut off Kaysan and VCB from the coast. They cut off Kaysan and VCB, and they can take Camp Carroll. Then the gooks come down Route 9 with tanks, and you can kiss fucking Quang Tri, Dong Ha, and Hue goodbye. That ain't politics."
The company started moving at dawn. It would be the eighth day without food. The kid with the broken leg was carried fireman style by friends who took turns. The senior squid gave the kid all the pills he felt his system could stand to keep him from screaming. As the company moved forward, everyone passed a message scratched into the rocks. First they shaved him, then they humped him to death. Chapter 10. The canyon ended. The company stared upward at a wall of jungle-covered cliffs and terraces that rose out of sight in the fog. The top of the wall was Hill 1609. Their job was to turn it into Firebase Skycap. Mellis's helmet fell from his head when he leaned backward and tried to see the top. He let it lie behind him and stared, stupefied, having no idea how they were going to climb the wall by nightfall. Fitch's voice came over the radio. Still deep in jungle, he could see nothing of what Mellis saw.
"Come on, Bravo One," he said impatiently. "Let's move it up there."
Mallis waved a hand at Jackson, pointing firmly upward with one index finger, and put his helmet back on. Jackson, at the base of the cliff, nodded to Cortell and Breuer. Cortell gave him the finger. Breuer shoved his black plastic glasses back on his nose and took a deep breath, looking up the cliff a long time before he exhaled. Jackson slipped the squad's coil of nylon gold-lined rope off his pack and passed it up to them. The two of them roped up, and Breuer started moving, his face against the cliff, pulling the rope up after him as Cortell paid it out. There seemed no place to go. Then Breuer found a root and tugged on it. It held. But vegetable holds were dangerous, and he knew it. He hauled himself shakily up to a narrow sloping ledge and tried to get secure with his butt up against the cliff and his boots on a nubbin of rock. He passed the rope around his waist in a hasty belay and then whispered as loud as he dared,
"Okay, I'm ready."
Cortell followed, pulled up by Breuer. Squeezing together on the ledge, leaning back on the cliff, they tied in to exposed roots and put a friction loop over a barely adequate bump of rock. They then dropped the rope end down again and belayed Jackson, who was followed by Mellis, then Hamilton, then Mallory's machine gun, then Mallory, then the boxes of ammunition that Mallory and Barber, his A-gunner, had been carrying, and so on until the next squad arrived with its own rope. Then Jackson's squad moved ever higher, repeating the process, but with different people leading. Soon the platoon was strung out in stages all along the cliff face. Fitch kept the rest of the company hidden in the jungle just in case there were NVA on top. Mellis knew it was the right thing to do, but he now regretted that his map skills had put first platoon at the lead so often. His face and nose were pressed against the wet cliff, and he inhaled the smells of moss and dirt. A single NVA squad on the top could kill half the platoon before the kids could scramble down to safety. A single NVA machine gun across from the canyon could probably get them all. They were fucked. 5 hours later, they were still climbing, surrounded by fog. Robertson and Germain from second squad were now on point, with Jacobs close behind them, stuttering encouragement. Germain had the squat M79 loaded with flechettes, so he could at least spray anyone looking down at them and fire the weapon one-handed without having to aim. Robertson, who as fire team leader could have ordered someone else to take point, hadn't had the heart to give the job to anyone but himself. He was now separated from his team by Jacobs, who himself had moved closer to the point position from his normally safer one behind the first fire team. Robertson was wondering whether to keep the safety of his M16 off or on. If it was on and he fucked up, he'd be very likely to kill Germain, who would certainly fall off the cliff, and, being roped into Robertson, take Robertson with him. On the other hand, if the enemy peered over the edge and Robertson didn't fire instantly on full automatic, because again he'd be one-handed, he might as well not even be carrying the damned weapon. He resolved the dilemma by nervously switching the safety on and off every minute or two. Moving up the steep face of the cliff made silence impossible. If the NVA were waiting, Robertson thought, the two of them for certain, and probably the entire squad, including the lieutenant and Hamilton, would have to be written off in order to get the company out. Compared, however, with the constant draining pull against gravity and hunger, and the obstinate rock face the jungle now presented to them, death didn't seem so bad. He saw that Lieutenant Mellis had reached a flat spot below him and was looking up. Robertson heaved himself and his heavy pack over a large rock formation. He stopped, breathing hard, perched precariously next to Germain, who was sitting with his back against the cliff, looking upward, holding his M79 above his head. Clearly the small space was safe for only one of them. There seemed no place he could move. His face was flushed and felt hot and full. He knew that he was crying because he had to keep wiping tears away to look for his next handhold. The lieutenant pointed a thumb upward, nodding encouragingly. "God knows how the guys behind us with the machine guns and mortars are doing," Robertson thought. "Or the poor fucker with the broken leg and the ones carrying him." He turned to look upward into the fog. The cliff stood above him, unmovable, impossibly steep, its unseen top seemingly beyond reach. Slowly, with each breath, his anger grew. At the cliff. The bullshit. The hunger. The war. Everything. He erupted in a frenzy of activity. He pumped his legs madly against the side of the cliff, scrambling for all he was worth on friction alone, moaning as he half-suppressed an angry scream. When he took off, he nearly shoved Germaine off the cliff, and Germaine actually raised the M79 to club him, but must have realized that he had Robertson on belay and didn't. Germaine paid out rope so that Robertson wouldn't be jerked short and fall. Robertson reached safety just a few meters above Germaine and apologized. Both of them were crying openly, like small children who needed to be fed and tucked into bed. They reached the summit just before dark. It was a narrow, razorback ridge of solid limestone, just wide enough for a single person to step along carefully, balanced between sheer drops on both sides. Obviously, no one had bothered to recon it. There was no possible place for a helicopter to land, much less an artillery battery. Mellis, too, was crying with exhaustion and frustration when he radioed Fitch that there wasn't room for the rest of the company on top. Fitch regrouped the company on a small saddle just below the final cliff, packing it into a space that would normally have been occupied by a platoon. The company dug in and spent the night there. The next morning they climbed the trail blazed by 1st Platoon, using the ropes that had been tied in place. Just as tired, but more confident, knowing 1st Platoon held the summit. It took the entire day, using every piece of explosive the company had left, to blast a small niche for an LZ out of the solid rock edge of the massive sweeping cliff that plunged more than 2,000 feet into a river canyon on the north side of the mountain. They blew their final bars of C4 just as darkness closed out any possibility of resupply. The next morning they were hacking away at the rock with their E-tools. At around midday the fog temporarily cleared and Fitch radioed to VCB. 30 minutes later, they all silently watched a CH-46 come chundering up the long valley they'd taken days to get through. The perch they'd blasted and scraped from the limestone was just large enough for the chopper to put down its rear wheels. The front two-thirds of the helicopter hovered dangerously in midair as the pilot fought to hold a machine long enough to unload its cargo. This maneuver drew murmurs of respect for the pilot's skill. The tailgate came down, and a group of Marines ran out holding their helmets in the blast of air. No supplies came with them. Marines from 3rd Platoon helped the kid with the broken leg aboard. The tailgate closed, and the helicopter simply fell off the cliff, picking up airspeed until it could fly. It curved away and faded into the mist. The Marines in the new group were full-fleshed and excited. Their camouflage helmet covers were conspicuously unripped, their jungle utilities bright green and brown. Hawk and Fitch walked up to them. They could see pickaxes, power saws, large new shovels, bundles of C4, even a surveyor's transit. A stocky first lieutenant, his silver bars gleaming on his collar, came over and shook hands.
"Hi," he said cheerily. "We're the pioneers from Golf Battery."
Hawk and Fitch stared at him. Finally, Hawk spoke.
"Well, if you're the pioneers, then we're the fucking aborigines."
An hour later, the same helicopter returned, an external load of sea rations, ammunition, and explosives swinging beneath it in a net that streamed out behind it on a cable. The helicopter released the net on the tiny LZ, then, as before, looped around the mountain to hover with its rear end almost touching the LZ and the rest of it hanging in space over the edge of the cliff. The tailgate flopped down to the ground, and another group of replacements came tumbling out, wondering where to run. They were followed by Jankowitz, who was wearing crisp, new camouflage utilities and a red silk scarf that smelled of perfume. He was holding a case of canned steaks.
"I heard you guys might be hungry," he said.
Mellis could have kissed him, but started stabbing at one of the cans with his K-bar instead. The next day the choppers delivered hundreds of pounds of explosives, a tiny bulldozer, and 3 marine engineers. It took the engineers several days to correct what the Marines of Bravo Company had thought was the mistake of selecting Skycap for an artillery base. What they didn't know was that long ago General Neitzel had figured out that he had the raw power to make the crooked places straight and would put his Marines where he wanted, not where nature would have allowed. The engineer simply blasted the top of the mountain down with plastic explosive and dynamite until it became wide enough to do the job. The normal back-breaking routine of providing security for a fire support base was resumed. The long, hungry march, now dubbed the Trail of Tears Op, faded into the past. Days were filled with the nerve-wracking tedium of patrols and nighttime listening posts, the stupefying work of laying barbed wire, hacking out fields of fire with K-bars, digging holes, improving positions, eating, shitting, drinking, pissing, nodding off, trying to stay awake. Still, it beat humping. Sometimes Mellis would find time to sit alone at the edge of the cliff. On days when the peak was out of the clouds, he would look into North Vietnam. Black clouds moved slowly before him at eye level. Far below, he could see the jungle-covered impression of a small river that surely joined the Ben Hai River to the north. Along the way it gathered the rainfall from Skycap and Tiger Tooth, the huge mountain that towered above them to the southeast. Because it took so long for security patrols to get off Skycap and back up, they didn't have time to cover the distance needed to reach the river, but its possibilities excited Mellis. Its winding path had the fascination of a deadly snake. Days passed, and Mellis kept coming back to the cliff's edge to stare at the river valley and daydream of glory and recognition. Then one evening he knew what he wanted to do. Fitch was bantering with Palak and Relsnik in soft whispers when Mellis poked his head inside the dripping ponchos. It was too dark to see anyone. "I've got an idea, Jim," he said. Fitch's voice came out of the dark. "Okay. What?" "You know the blue line just north of here that hits the Ben High?"
"Yeah,"
Fitch said uncertainly. "Nagulian's got to have all sorts of trails there. He had to in order to supply the attack on Khon Tien last year. If they ever want to get Quang Tri, other than come right across the Z in tanks and get fucked up by Navy air and Army tanks and artillery, they've only got two alternatives. Hold Mutter's Ridge, which means resupply via the trails along the Ben Hai, or kick us out of Vandy in the rock pile, barrel ass down Route 9, hit Com Low, and take Quang Tri from the west."
"Mellis," Fitch asked patiently, "what do you want?"
"I think we ought to recon that valley. It's like a warehouse next to a freeway."
"The Ben Hai's no fucking freeway, sir,"
Relsnik said quietly.
"But it's got gook tobos every fucking click," Palak chimed in, "and they ain't asking for no quarters either."
"I don't plan on going down to Ben Hai," Mellis said. He turned toward Fitch's voice. "It provides a good screening action in case someone's coming up the valley to hit us."
"Yeah, you'd be the fucking screen holes all over you," Palak said.
Fitch was silent. "It wouldn't hurt to show battalion we're taking some initiative," Mellis added. After another long silence, Fitch said, "Okay, you got people crazy enough to go with you, be my guest. Take Daniels if he wants to go. How long you want to be out?"
"I figure 3 days.
Mellis dug out his map and Fitch switched on his flashlight. Faint red light illuminated the interior of the hooch. Mellis saw Palak and Relsnik curled up next to their radios and their poncho liners. The next morning, 1st Platoon had palace guard while squads from 2nd and 3rd platoons went out on security patrols. Security outposts disappeared into the jungle on the south side of the mountain or set up with binoculars on the cliff faces. Work parties were formed to lay more wire, burn garbage, and dig larger latrines. Mellis asked for volunteers. As he expected, almost everyone preferred the work parties. Also as expected, Vancouver was the first to say he'd go. He talked Daniels into coming. Mellis had to send the word out again for an M79 man. Eventually Gambaccini showed up, saying he was coming only because Bass had mentioned to him that it was his turn to volunteer. Fredrickson felt honor-bound to go along, since he was still the only platoon corpsman. They all took 4 hours to sleep that afternoon. Then they blackened their hands and faces and tied down their equipment. In the darkness, it took more than 3 hours to reach the jungle floor, by rope most of the way. Vancouver took point with an M-16 rather than his M-60 so everybody's ammunition would be compatible. He was followed by Mellis. Next came Daniels with the radio and Gambaccini with the grenade launcher. Fredrickson took up the rear, walking nearly backward, his M-16 pointing into the blackness behind them. They moved silently beneath towering trees that rustled in the dark above them. Eventually they reached the stream and made their way north alongside it. They used its sound both to guide them and to mask their movements. Mellis's senses were keenly alive. A thrill surged up his spine. He felt wonderfully powerful and dangerous. Vancouver on point. 4 combat-trained Marines. Daniels backed with a battery of howitzers. If the clouds broke, jets from Da Nang or possibly from carriers in the China Sea might show up to support them. They could even call in the Air Force's Puff the Magic Dragon with its fiery streams of 40-millimeter shells from on high. He pictured his small team quietly stalking the enemy. A song from his college days rose in his memory. Ian and Sylvia, guitars driving, close harmony pushing the wilderness, singing about outlaws. In the darkness, Mellis could sense the stream slowing, indicating that the land had begun to broaden as they left the high peaks behind them. The underbrush also grew thicker, reducing their own already slow pace. Above, he could just make out the dark silhouettes of the huge trees against the barely perceptible lighter color of the cloudy night sky. Suddenly, Vancouver sank to one knee. Everyone quickly squatted, rifles outward in assigned sectors.
"Trail,"
Vancouver whispered. Mellis moved forward in a low crouch. His hand felt packed mud.
"Take it,"
he whispered. The trail headed eastward, ever lower, and now they moved more rapidly away from Skycap. The trail was what Mellis had wanted. He'd been proved right. But it occurred to him that they might not be the only ones out tonight. He tried to force the nagging fear from his mind and concentrate on moving silently. "Don't let water in the canteens slosh. Check the taped metal on the slings. Heel down, feel for anything that could make noise. Try to keep the breathing even." What would happen, he wondered, if they ran into a major unit? He'd stupidly assumed that only small units would be on the trails at night. But Vancouver would see the enemy first. They'd pull back in time. It would be easy to envelop the 5 of them, however. What if one of them was wounded? Mellis forced himself to think more positively. They'd find a perfect ambush spot. The gooks would come down the trail, talking, unaware. Daniels would give the word and the artillery would erupt. They'd uncover intelligence that would alter the whole division's strategy or foil an attack on Quang Tri. A medal. A story in the newspaper back home. But what if they didn't get set up in time and met the gooners head-on? What if some of them were wounded and the rest couldn't run? Something ahead snapped, and Mellis's heartbeat accelerated as the shadow of Vancouver sank quickly to the mud. Mellis went down on one knee, eyes straining. The wind moved softly through the jungle, bringing the smell of damp rot. It also rustled the trees, filling the air with a steady hiss. Trying to hear anything was maddening. The failure to hear could mean his death. The fear made his heart pound and his breathing shallow and more rapid, all in turn making it more difficult to hear. No one moved. Everyone was waiting for an order from Mellis. Mellis wanted to look at his map. If he could see the contour lines of Hill 1609 drawn on the map, it would help him feel that it and the company were still really there. In this darkness, it was a dream. There was only this ground, this smell, this small group of humans. He slowly reached for his map. Then he realized he'd have to turn on his flashlight to see it. To appear to be doing something, he slid his compass up before his nose and opened the case. The pale green glow of the needle's tip swung drunkenly, then steadied, rocking slightly. Guilty anxiety struck him. What if the snap up ahead meant a group just like them, waiting to open up the minute there was more sound? He silently closed the compass case. What good did a fucking compass do if you couldn't see where you were? He felt a hand tap his boot.
"I don't think it was nothing, Lieutenant,"
Vancouver whispered.
Malus knew he'd have to either move forward or decide clearly that this was the enemy and pull back into a hasty defensive circle. He also knew he could not do the latter without looking foolish. Another part of him finally took command and he whispered, "Let's go." They rose to their feet. Carefully they stepped forward, heel down, feel for something solid, toe, lift heel, next foot, heel down, feel for loose sticks, toe, lift heel. They all moved the same way, quietly, slowly. The march of the reconnaissance team. This march was not in 4-4 time. There was no time. There was forever. Trees creaked unseen above them. Direction became meaningless. The compass needle pointed only to darkness. The flashes from the muzzle of Vancouver's M16 seared their eyes. Ghostly trees stood silhouetted, exposed, as if by flashbulbs. Grotesque shadows leaped into being and died as everything went black again. Green spots plagued their night vision, the explosions echoing and re-echoing in their ears. Malus had glimpsed the grimace of pain and fear on an NVA soldier's face. They crawled backward, hearts pounding, panting with adrenaline. Malus bumped into Daniels, who was pushing out to his assigned sector. He felt other boots touch his legs as Fredrickson and Gambaccini reached the circle. Malus quickly whispered names. Everyone checked in okay. The radio was frantically keying the check-in signal. Daniels keyed back the okay signal. The radio stopped.
"I only saw one Vancouver,"
Malus whispered.
"That's all I saw."
"Let's get the fuck out of here,"
Gambaccini whispered.
"Got to check the body for documents,"
Malus whispered grimly.
"Oh, fuck, man."
They heard a moan.
"Oh, shit, he's alive,"
Fredrickson whispered.
"Now what do we do?"
Gambaccini asked.
"Pump some more rounds into him,"
Daniel said.
"It'll give away our position,"
Malus whispered quickly.
"Throw a Mike-26. There can't be just one of the fuckers out there,"
Vancouver said.
"He's got to have friends behind him. I want the fucking documents. We need them for intelligence." "Oh, shit, Lieutenant. Fuck the fucking documents. Shut up, Gambaccini."
Malus thought furiously.
"Vancouver, go ahead and grease him with a grenade.
That way the enemy would not be able to locate them."
"When I get the word, we all move toward the blue line."
He waited a moment.
"Ready?" "Yeah. Go."
Vancouver rose to one knee and threw the grenade. An arc of brilliant fire erupted down the trail as they scrambled for the river. Again, they waited.
"Did you get him?"
Malus whispered.
"I don't know."
They waited. Fitch came up on the radio, asking them to break radio silence. Malus told him the situation in terse, barely audible whispers. They continued to wait.
"There's gotta be more of the fuckers. Let's get out of here, Lieutenant. God damn it, Gambaccini, I want the documents."
Malus, too, wanted to run, but he knew that bringing in solid information would make him look good.
"I don't think there's any more of them,"
Malus whispered. No one answered, since no one had been addressed. It was clearly Malus's problem. The others would do as they were told.
"Let's go check him out,"
Malus finally said. They crawled forward through the rotting sticks and fungus of the jungle floor. When they reached the body, Vancouver quickly pulled at the AK-47 that was attached to it with a shoulder sling. The man moaned.
"Fuck,"
Daniels whispered.
"He's still alive."
Malus sent Vancouver and Gambaccini to guard the approaches up and down the trail and went through the wounded soldier's pockets. He scanned the contents of the man's wallets with his red flashlight, trying to ignore the soldier's eyes, which were rolling with fear, pinkish brown in the red light. He was no older than Daniels or Gambaccini. Fredrickson cut the kid's uniform open, revealing 3 bullet holes in his abdomen. There were gaping exit wounds in his lower back. Shrapnel from the grenade had smashed through his left leg and shattered his shin bone. Fredrickson looked up at Malus.
"He won't last but an hour or two,"
less if we try to move him. Those are his guts coming out of the exit holes, and I think that's part of his pancreas. The chart's never looked the way it really is, so it's hard to say. Malice wet his lips nervously. If only he could locate the soldier's unit. They could bring the sky down on it.
We're going to pull back and wait for him to move,
he said.
What? We'll pretend we're leaving. I want to see which way he crawls for help.
Mellis stuffed the wallet into his pocket and cut off the kid's shoulder patches with his K-bar. The kid's eyes darted left and right with fear as Mellis worked around him with a large knife. Mellis thought about cutting off the belt buckle but hesitated, wanting to appear more professional.
Okay, let's go,
he whispered. He switched off the red light. It was like heat being taken away.
You forgot the belt buckle, Lieutenant,
Daniel said.
10 cases of coke in Da Nang, minimum.
Daniels groped for the buckle in the dark and quickly cut it loose. They moved off about 50 meters and Mellis formed them into a tight circle. After 10 minutes of silence, they heard a moan and then a very ordinary sound.
Shit,
Vancouver whispered, almost in disbelief.
He's fucking crying.
Mellis shut his eyes. The crying didn't stop and was soon mixed with pleading foreign words. The sound cut through Mellis like a shaft of steel. The sobbing rose and fell in intensity. The pleading continued, a child crying for help, afraid to die.
Jesus Christ, shut the fuck up,
Mellis whispered aloud. The others were silent, waiting for Mellis's lead.
Shit,
Mellis finally said.
Let's go find him.
The youth had managed to crawl nearly 30 meters from where they'd left him. Mellis turned on his flashlight, shielding it with his hand. The soldier had ground dirt into his mouth, and it had mixed with blood-flecked saliva in his teeth. He watched the Marines, eyes wide, lips pleading silently.
Well, sir, it looks like his friends are east of here, Fredrickson said.
Yeah,
Mellis whispered. There was an uncomfortable silence.
Do you think he'll live?
Mellis asked.
Won't make much difference anyway.
How come?
Tigers, it's a pretty easy piece of meat.
He'd die before then, wouldn't he?
Fucked if I know, I'm just an HM3.
Suddenly the kid broke down and an anguished cry escaped his lips, followed by more frightened, choking sobbing. Fredrickson switched the safety off of his M16.
It won't be the first time, sir, he said.
No, don't.
Mellis switched off his own safety. He pointed the barrel directly at the kid's head. The kid looked up at him, crying loudly, mucus running from his nose. Mellis switched the safety back on.
We can't,
he whispered.
Lieutenant, do him a favor. He's going to die. We don't know that. I fucking know it. Maybe we could get him back.
Fredrickson sighed.
We'd trail his guts all over the place. Even if he did live, we'd just have to turn him over to the Arvins, and they'd kill him slower than the Tigers.
We don't know that for certain.
Mellis towed the kid gently. Fredrickson placed the barrel of his rifle against the kid's head.
Don't shoot him,
Mellis said coldly.
That's an order, Fredrickson.
He backed away from the boy.
He might make it. Maybe his buddies are real close. If they are,
Gambaccini said,
let's get the fuck out of here.
You going to leave him, Lieutenant?
Fredrickson asked.
He might live,
Mellis said.
There's a chance one of his guys could pick him up. They must have heard the firing.
He struggled for more reasons.
It'd be murder.
Nobody said anything. The jungle had gone silent. Mellis no longer had any illusions about their vulnerability. They were alone, just as this single crying stranger at their feet was alone. Their reason for being here probably not much different from his.
East, sir,
Vancouver asked.
The way he was heading.
Mellis didn't say anything. The others shifted nervously.
Let's get the fuck out of here,
Gambaccini finally whispered.
I'm cold.
There was a tense silence. Maldus could hear them all breathing, smell the sweat rising off them in the darkness. He felt Daniels next to him with the large PRC-25 on his back, scratchy whispers coming from the handset. Maldus rubbed his face, feeling the slight growth of his beard. He knew it was no use pretending anymore. He was simply too frightened to push farther ahead into the darkness.
"Daniels, tell Bravo we're coming in." "All right,"
Gambaccini whispered.
"I ain't complaining,"
whispered Daniels.
"But how come?"
Again there was silence as Maldus struggled for an answer. Finally he said,
"Because I don't want to be out here anymore."
All that night, Maldus didn't say a word beyond confirming Daniels's map reading. When morning came, Maldus expected the others to avoid looking him in the eye. Surprisingly, everyone kept offering him reasons he could give Fitch for coming in early. He could say that someone was ill or had turned an ankle. As they began to feel safer, climbing back up Skycap, the excuses for coming in grew wilder and more outrageously funny, and the imaginary profits from the AK-47 and the belt buckle soared. Maldus was unable to join the general levity. He couldn't look at Fredrickson. He knew Fredrickson thought he should have killed the wounded boy but didn't have the guts. He wondered if Fredrickson was right, just as he kept wondering if he was going to lie to Fitch about the mission. When he arrived at the CP, he found Fitch and Hawk sitting cross-legged eating sea rations. He pulled the Vietnamese kid's wallet out of his pocket, weighing it in his hand. "Sorry for aborting the mission, Jim. I don't know what to say for myself." "Say you got scared," Fitch said. "Shit, confession's good for the soul. I told battalion you went out on a kill team, bagged a gook and didn't have anyone hurt. A complete success."
"Great."
Maldus kept looking at the wallet in his hand. "Besides, it's good you came in early," Fitch said. "We're skying out to VCB tomorrow. Just got word." Maldus continued to look at the wallet, saying nothing. Hawk, who had been watching Maldus through the steam that rose from his pear-can coffee mug, handed Maldus the cup. Maldus gave a brief smile and took a drink. His hand was shaking. Hawk said in a calm voice,
"Something happened. You want to talk about it?"
Maldus didn't answer right away. Then he said, "I think I know where the gooks are." He pulled out his map and pointed to the spot, his hand still trembling.
"How do you know that, Mel?"
Hawk asked. "From the direction he crawled after he was shot." Maldus tossed the wallet down at Fitch. Then he dug into his pocket and pulled out the soldier's unit and rank patches. He looked at them. Then at Fitch and Hawk, who were no longer eating.
"I let him crawl toward home with his guts hanging out."
He started sobbing.
"I just left him there."
Snot was streaming from his nose.
"I'm so sorry. I'm so fucking sorry."
His hands were now shaking with his body as he clenched the two pieces of cloth to his eyes. Chapter 11. The chopper's deck vibrated beneath them as they leaned back against the thin metal that separated them from several thousand feet of empty space. The trip from Skycap to Vandegrift Combat Base was like magic. Jungle-covered mountains that would have taken weeks to cross flashed beneath them in minutes. Vancouver wondered if his gook sword or his space blanket had come in yet. Skosh was dreaming about R&R in Sydney and wondering what it was really like to have intercourse with a girl. Hawk was wondering if this might be his last time out in the bush, if maybe he could wangle a job in the rear. Fitch kept going over the events of the long march, preparing his case, worried sick about the disgrace of being relieved of command. He also wanted to get out of his filthy clothing and take a shower. China was counting the number of people ahead of him to pull KP duty and wondering what he could do to jump the line before the company skied out on another operation. He needed time in the rear for organizing. Polini was kneeling at a shot-out porthole watching the landscape slide beneath them. He wondered if any of his brothers or sisters were thinking about him. Cassidy wanted to sleep and sleep and forget the shame of one of his own men wanting to kill him. Goodwin wanted to get drunk.
So did Ridlow, Bass, Scheller, Ryder, Tillman, Palak, Gambaccini, Germain, and a lot of others. Jackson wanted to get stoned, as did Mole, Cortell, Breuer, Mallory, Jacobs, Fredrickson, Robertson, and Relsnick. Jankiewicz fingered the now filthy red silk scarf he'd stuffed in his pocket, not wanting to look at it, but not wanting to throw it away. It still smelled faintly of Susie's perfume. He didn't care how he did it, he just wanted to forget where he was. Mellis, left behind with a squad to guide Kilo Company into the lines, kept seeing the twisted face, running with snot, of the young Vietnamese soldier. He wondered why the kid had been out there alone in the first place and whether there was a chance he'd lived. While the chundering workhorse helicopters flew back and forth between VCB and Skycap, sending out the freshly outfitted troops of Kilo Company and picking up the ragged troops from Bravo Company, Colonel Mulvaney was returning from a briefing at Dong Ha. The stupid cordon operation was over, and Mulvaney was anxious to be snooping and pooping, as he called it, interdicting the flow of NVA supplies into the Aoshao Valley and toward Da Nang, screening the NVA from the fertile plains to the east of them, and keeping open Route 9, the only road running from the coast through the mountains to Khe San and Laos. If the NVA ever got their armor down that road on a cloudy day, it would be Katie Bar the gate. "Is that Bravo coming in from Skycap, Corporal Odegaard?" Mulvaney asked his driver. Odegaard slowed the jeep as they passed the groups of two or three trudging wearily alongside the muddy road. When they passed a Marine with an Australian-style bush cover, brim turned up on the right side and a sawed-off machine gun, Odegaard said, "That's them, sir. There's Vancouver, the guy who fucked up the ambush for them."
"Pull over when you get past those crates over there."
"Aye, aye, sir." Odegaard swung the jeep off the road and came to a stop. Mulvaney watched two kids without trousers go by, waddling to avoid irritating the ringworm that covered them from waist to ankle. His experienced eye noted the rot on hands and faces, the state of disrepair of the mortars and the way the kids' rotting uniforms hung off their thin bodies. "You want me to turn the engine off, sir?"
"No, let's go."
Before they came upon Bravo Company, Mulvaney had been telling Odegaard one of his better sea stories. He didn't finish it and was silent all the way back to regimental headquarters. During the briefing, he said little. Toward the end, the subject of who would supply the company for Bald Eagle Sparrowhawk duty came up. Bald Eagle was a company held on constant alert, combat loaded, at the edge of the VCB airstrip. It was there to instantly reinforce any unit in trouble or to exploit a tactical advantage. Sparrowhawk was a platoon within that company for the smaller jobs, like getting recon teams out of trouble. No one liked the duty. The Marines spent their days doing make work while ridden with anxiety because at any instant the company could be launched into combat.
"We had it last, sir," the commander of 3rd Battalion said. "That makes it your turn, Simpson," Mulvaney said.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
Simpson said, writing it in his green pocket notebook, clearly unhappy, as it would leave him with only three companies. After the briefing, Mulvaney headed for the door as soon as he saw Simpson and Blakely about to leave.
"Why don't you stop by for a drink, Simpson?"
he said. Blakely, clearly not invited, nervously stubbed out his cigarette.
"It'd be my pleasure, sir," Simpson responded. "When would be convenient?"
"Right now."
Mulvaney walked away. Mulvaney was pouring two shot glasses of Jefferson's Reserve when Simpson pushed through the flap of his tent.
"You use water?"
he asked, reaching into his little refrigerator. Simpson said he'd have it straight. Mulvaney poured himself some water and dumped the shot of bourbon into it. He raised his glass.
"To the core,"
he said.
"To the core,"
Simpson echoed. He tossed down the drink in a single motion and, seeming to realize what he'd done, nervously wiped his mouth with his hand.
"Sit, sit."
Mulvaney motioned toward a chair. Simpson sat. Mulvaney leaned against the edge of his desk. He took another slow drink, then looked at Simpson.
"We are engaged in a shitty war," he said slowly. "A shitty little war that is tearing apart the thing I love." Do you love the Marine Corps, Simpson?
Yes, sir, I do.
I mean, do you really love it? Do you go to bed with it at night? Wake up with it in the morning? See its sour side? See it when it's sick and tired? Not just when it's glorious? Do you think about it all the time? Or do you think about where it's going to get you?
Well, sir, I...
I'll tell you, Simpson. You think about where it's going to get you. You use it. Either that or you let someone else use you so it'll get them somewhere. I don't know which is worse.
Shut up. Yes, sir.
And don't worry. It's all my nickel, and none of it's going into your fucking fitness report.
Mulvaney walked over to look at a framed photograph on the wall. It showed a Marine platoon in summer uniforms on a cold, rainy day. On it was written, New Zealand, July 1942. Mulvaney nodded toward it. Without looking at Simpson, he said quietly,
Half of those guys are dead.
He paused briefly.
A lot of them my fault.
He turned to look at Simpson.
America uses us like whores, Simpson. When it wants a good fuck, it pours in the money and we give it a moment of glory. When it's over, it sneaks out the back door and pretends it doesn't know who we are.
Mulvaney swirled the ice, watching it dissolve.
Yeah, we're whores.
He continued, almost to himself now.
I admit it, but we're good ones. We're good at fucking. We like our work. So the customer gets ashamed afterward. So hypocrisy's always been part of the profession, we know that.
Mulvaney narrowed his eyes and looked at Simpson.
But this time the customer doesn't want to fuck. Wants to play horsey and come in through the back door. And he's riding us around the room with a fucking bridle and whip and spurs.
Mulvaney shook his head.
We ain't good at that. It turns our stomach. And it's destroying us.
Mulvaney was silent. Simpson looked at the bottle on the desk, then quickly back to his own empty shot glass.
"Did you look at Bravo Company when they came in today?"
Mulvaney asked.
"I talked with their skipper, Lieutenant Fitch, sir."
"Did you see them, Simpson?"
Mulvaney's voice started to rise.
"No, sir."
"They look like shit."
"Yes, sir. I'll get right on it, sir. I'll talk with Lieutenant Fitch. I've been thinking of relieving him ever since he was on Matterhorn."
"It ain't Fitch, Simpson."
Mulvaney took a deep breath and another drink.
"They've been used. Badly. How long they been out in the bush?"
"By bush, do you mean on a fire support base doing routine patrols or actually in the jungle on an operation?"
"I mean how long without regular food, regular sleep, safety, baths, vitamins?"
The last word was a dangling question and an accusation.
"I don't care what the fuck you have to do to get it, but I'm going to inspect Bravo Company's garbage cans tomorrow night, and I want them full of orange peels and apple cores."
Simpson pulled out his green notebook and wrote something down.
"God damn it, Simpson, put that away. If you can't remember this..."
"Yes, sir."
Simpson put the notebook back in his pocket. Mulvaney turned from Simpson. When he spoke, he again addressed the photograph.
"Simpson, I'm tired. I'm tired of being used. Killing for pay and politics is prostitution enough, but doing it this way sickens me. It sickens my soul, what's left of it."
He slowly turned and pointed a thick forefinger at Simpson.
"But you... you and that fucking three of yours, you're one of the customers this time. But let me tell you something. I'll be goddamned if I'll let my troops play the customer's fucking game, even if the brass are."
Mulvaney was breathing heavily. His face was hot. He leaned over the desk.
"The next time you tell me one of your companies is in good shape before I send them on an operation, by God, you better not be lying. Get out of here! You're dismissed!"
Simpson put his cap on and left, trembling. Mulvaney swept the empty glasses from his desk with a cry of frustration. He sat down and watched the ice form puddles on the floor. Then he walked over to the picture on the wall and stood there looking at it for a long time.